Melanie, like years you were involved, any particular contributions going on there?
Okay. I think the first time we started showing at the funnel, like it was with Kim Causey, right? Like, because at that time in the Fast Worms, it was Kim Causey and myself. That was it. Even though it's not what they say on their website,
right,
they kind of did. And the facts, like, all point, you know, like all the newspaper articles point that it was Kim and I. And when we'd been at OCA, I think the last year of OCA, we discussed about making this film called Flowers and Numbers with Gary Dalt. And so finally we had made the film, like by 1980 we finally got enough, like to, it was like we'd go to like Sally Ann's and buy cheap little Super 8 cameras, you know, very mechanical, very straightforward, but they were like silent. And we shot this one movie, Flowers and Numbers, and then we heard about the funnel, and we heard about their Monday open screenings. I believe it was on Mondays. So we brought in the film, and they really liked it. You know, like we were really surprised at how much they liked it, even though it didn't really have any sound with it. And at that time, like even though Kim and I were together, we're like kind of an open relationship. So she was going out with Donald Sutherland also. So our real career kind of started, like the real Fast Worm like surge ahead, like started when Kim, I think it was 80 or might have been 81. I think it was 80. If I look at all the films, like I have one film online, Zigzag is online. I don't know if you've seen it, but anyway. And it's one of the first films we ever showed at the funnel that had sound. So Donald gave Kim for her birthday, it was April, gave her, or March, gave her everything you ever needed to make Super 8 movies. He gave editor, you know, like cameras, everything, projectors, like it was just this huge box, and the chauffeur brought it in. And Kim and I just kind of like looking at it, like, and it sat there for about a month because we were just kind of overwhelmed, like it was just tons of all this equipment. And it was all stereo, so we were really set to go. So the first film was Zigzag, and I had a dream of this movie I wanted to shoot. And so I wrote a script, and then we shot it. And we brought it to the funnel, and we showed it at their Monday screenings, and everybody went absolutely nuts. They couldn't believe, you know, here's a stereo sound, Super 8 film. So that's basically our introduction to the funnel, like really where things started to surge forward. So after that, it was like almost like once a month, we would kind of make a new film. And we started using our studios because we both wanted to work in the film industry, but back then it was really tight, like it was IATSE basically and NABET, and there was like it was almost impossible to get work in the film industry. So we converted our studios into like basically like places where we could build sets and stuff like that. And also we started like going and having exhibitions, and in the exhibitions we'd use the exhibitions as backdrops for movies. So every month, like I said, it kept going. And like it was like Suicide Reentry we did. There's a long list. I think they are online, I'm pretty sure, or else I can provide you with the film list. And so then we slowly kind of, for the first year, it was just basically coming in, and every week, sometimes we would just like just take whatever was left cut on the floor. And actually, that's how the name Fast Worms came about, was because we always would cut. We had this kind of joke where it was going like, when you make a film, like make it the length of a worm, like for editing. So we would just get like those little cassettes, like 3 or 4 minute cassettes, and we just kind of pull it off, and we just kind of like, without even looking at it, just kind of cut, put them all in a bag, and then pull it out of the bag and put it all back together again. And so this is how, like, you know, this is like the officials, you know, how the name comes. I think it's because we'd seen, back then the film festival also, like, they used to have these silver and gold cards. So a friend of mine and I, we made some fake silver passes, like, with pencils and everything. It was like, and photocopies. It's, you got to remember, you know, it's like, the early, like the 80s, like things are still really primitive, right? So we went and saw all of Fassbinder's films and all of Jean-Luc Godard's films. So like then we were really like charged where we wanted to make feature-length movies. So we did two films like which were based on installations at the Funnel, and one was like Be My Magnet, and the other one was Fish Hooks to You, where we actually and I've got lots of photographs of that installation. Like, and basically what we did is we just kind of, because a lot of the early Fastworm installations were just stuff we would find, and we just recycled instead of using art materials. So we found like stretchers and TVs and staircases, and we dragged it all to the Funnel, and we just kind of hammered it all together. And about like a month earlier, I'd found like a barrel of chocolate, like about a 300 pound barrel of chocolate, 400 pound, like I rolled it to my studio in Berkeley Street, because at that time we lived only two blocks from the Funnel. Anyway, we took that barrel of chocolate and we brought it over to the gallery, and we just spent, you know, a whole night like just sitting there chipping away at it and melting it and coating the whole installation with chocolate and then painting it up. So then when people would come in, they could smell the chocolate, but you couldn't really see it because it was under paint and all these. So, and we shot one film there. And then later, like it would have been like, I don't really remember like the, I'd have to look at the specific dates, but afterwards I did the installation, which was Be My Magnet. And we incorporated those two films to make Fauves Get Land Legs. And that we presented, it was the first time we ever presented a feature film like at the Funnel. Also, we were kind of inspired too, because they had Kenneth Anger came to the Funnel to present some of his films. Like they showed Lucifer Rising and all these. So we were really like, you know, that really kind of really fired us up. And I was like sending letters to Kenneth Anger back and forth. Like it was really like, wow, we're right in the middle of it, you know. So the Funnel was really good like that for us, you know, just to be able to pull us into the film world. And what happened is, so it's like, I think as time went on, the Funnel just became, we stopped showing at the Funnel as much. I got involved with the Cameron, and then we started showing at the Cameron, and showing at the Spadina, at Spadina Hotel, which they had the Spadina, what was it this, what did they call it? They had a name for the upstairs, like they had a special lounge. And so the screenings kind of started happening all over town instead of just specifically at the Funnel.
That was like in the later 80s or mid 80s?
That would have been like 83 maybe. Oh, okay. It went really fast. Our involvement with the Funnel was maybe a 2.5-3 year period. And after that, it's just, we're just spreading out like to other places. So, but we were going like on a regular basis to see whatever people were doing, you know, at the Funnel.
How would you describe the philosophy of the Funnel?
I think it's like, it's the philosophy, I think, is like much like, you have to understand like the gallery system like at that time was very, very open, right? And so what we liked about it was not as structured. So like if you had something good, you could just kind of, like most galleries in the city, if you had a piece of artwork that was really like you felt confident about, you could just walk in a gallery with a slides of it and you could say, I want a show, and they'd say, we'll book you next week or in a month. And there was none of this like kind of waiting or having to write long dissertations about like what you were going to do or why it was being made. So the Funnel operated in that same thing. So of course, like when they first started seeing our sound films, they just right away, like, you know, we could walk in any, you know, on, we started having specific screenings. Like there was nights where it was like all night, you know, just Fastworm movies. So it'd be like 4 or 5 hours. And we were working on, by 1984, we were working on a 24-hour long film. We wanted to see if we could, and we didn't get I think we got to about 6 hours or 5 hours, and then it was just like we, by that point, our installations were more important than our films, like, because the art dealers didn't know how to kind of monetize, like, these films, right? So the focus shifted over to more art objects. And I think the last film we did was called Murder Clinic. So,
how would you characterize the relationship between the funnel and the larger community at the time?
Because the funnel was out on the east side, people, there was a stigma like in Toronto about the east side and the west side, like it was the east side artists and there was like the west side artists. And Kim and I had come from Ottawa, and like in 79, 78, like I'd been here like since like the early 70s at OCA. Because I took film like at OCA, and but I took it more just so I could get my hands on equipment to be able to do stuff. But after a few tries, it was so cumbersome. I decided that, you know, because a lot of people were doing video, and it, back then video was like a suitcase about the size of this table, you know, and just as high. And it was like you would, it was stupid. You would haul it home, and then you'd open it up, and there'd be one little cable missing, and it was like. It was nothing to be made, right? That's why also we went to Super 8, because it was kind of like you could have a Super 8 camera, smash it, put it back together with tape, and use it again. You know, it was so mechanical and so, you know, you could really take control of the actual equipment. But like I said, they were really extremely supportive with us. But like when we'd have openings, it would be people we knew. But it was always like a set group of people. Like it's again, like it's like the West Side artists like seldom travel to the East Side. And it's like a whole other structure, sort of, it's like a thinking. The city, there's something about the crossing the Don was like, oh, you're going over there, right? It's like.
But it wasn't on the other side of the Don. Like it was.
It was at King and just past Parliament.
Yeah. So it wasn't
on the
quite
south side.
But it was pretty close, like to the Don.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, oh, sorry, I'm talking about. Sorry, I didn't mean the Don. I meant Yonge Street.
Oh yeah, it still is kind of like that too.
Now it's. I still live in the east. Like yeah. I live on the other side of the Don now, and there are like artists that are over there. Like I think even like Martha from Martha and the Muffins like lives close by. There's a bunch of people that kind of kept moving further east. You know. I never really liked the west side. It just felt, even though I lived at the Cameron for 10 years, but it was only because it was free.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why, because I did the ants on the Cameron, right. So they gave me, like, you know, free rent for 10 years.
Wow.
So.
Do you remember what the neighborhood was like? Because we're trying to piece together.
Okay, the neighborhood was basically, after the beauty about young, like, you have to remember in the 70s, like, after 5 o'clock, the city would shut down. Okay? And the city belonged to the artists, basically, because there would be nobody downtown. It's like, you think of like Queen West, or even like King, like on King Street, we could do anything. We were just like in these warehouses where you could like rip, like I ripped the windows. We did a movie called Suicide Reentry. And the lighting wasn't good enough. So what I did is, I was living in a warehouse, so I took out the windows, these big 8x10 windows. I ripped them all out, so it was just open to the elements. And I really, my studio was so hot that even in the winter, I didn't bother to put the windows back in because my place was so hot. So you'd be lying in the loft, sleeping, and it'd be like snowflakes going by your face. So, and across the street from, which was just like, you know, like I said, 2 blocks from the funnel, we were at the bottom of the Esplanade in Berkeley, and people used to dump cars, like, you know, when they'd be car thefts, you'd just hear a car crash, and I'd look out the window, and it'd be some guys drunk getting out of a car and running away, or like a lot of times, like, hookers would come, and it'd be like all this action happening right below your window. So that's basically, people didn't go to the, it didn't come, you know, like to the east side whatsoever. They avoided it as much as possible. I think that's why, like, the funnel was like, you know, like, especially in those early years, they just, they didn't, people didn't go there. Because I remember, because actually when I moved to, there was a short brief period where we would just like, we would break into studios and just like, you know, like you had nowhere to stay, so you just kind of find a warehouse, kick in the door, put a new lock on the door, and live there. And then one day the landlord shows up and says, "Who the hell are you?" and "Get out of here." And then you would just kind of leave the building and wait like a half hour and then go into another studio, kick that door in. You know, so that was basically the mentality of the times. It was like nobody worked and everyone just did their artwork, and there was no real outside pressure to really do anything.
Right. It's interesting because when the funnel moved from 507 King Street to Soho,
yeah,
we've been talking to people, and like one of the reasons they did that was to bring it more central.
So yeah,
that kind of changed. I know you were gone by then, but that would have, you know, changed their whole thing.
Dynamic, yeah.
People had to be in the know, I guess. You really had to like want to go down there.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's true.
So would you describe the core audience that attended these sorts of screenings or events? Was it like a stable of people rather than like?
Yeah. It was like if people came, like I know for our openings or our screenings, if people came, it's because they knew us. They would. It's not because the group, you know what I mean? Not because of what was happening at the funnel was, you know, outside that sphere. It was just because it was just much more more opportunities to do stuff, right? Because there was no rule like of anything. I was working also. It's funny because actually one of the few times I was working as a guard, a security guard at the AGO. So, because I was a security guard, we did shoot, like there's, I know online there's one, we shot this little short film, like we went in one night and I told the guard, like the other guards, we want to shoot a movie called Snap Out of It, which ended up being Chino Choo Choo. And it was me walking by paintings in the AGO and snapping my fingers and going Snap Out of It and then falling on my face. Because the floors were like wood floors, it would make this big booming sound, right? And online there's a film of me, like we did a little short excerpt where I crawled inside the Claes Oddenburg hamburger and then I come out of it like waving everyone. So like I said, like I would walk home, like you could take your clothes off and walk home after 5 o'clock and no one would even know. There was just nothing happening. And it was like totally like deserted. Everything was closed. Everything like from university like over like on Queen West was like there might have been like a few like the Goulash Palace or something like that, but it was like it was nobody. I think that's why the scene was so alive, because you could have like there was booze cans everywhere and
there was no like businesses to kind of ruin
complain
everything.
No, and there was no people, no one would even think, like at 5 o'clock everyone jumped in their cars and drive through the suburbs, you know.
Yeah.
So the whole town was yours.
Once the censorship issues starting the funnel, I know, plaguing the funnel, I know John Porter was saying that's when like they started getting health inspectors coming in and they had to do all these renovations. So do you think that would probably change?
Yeah, because I remember one time we had to submit our films to the censor board to be looked at.
Yeah.
You know, and our big complaint was like, they didn't even have the equipment to look at Super 8 films. And like we used to just get really pissed off because we go like, what if they, you know, because it's all just, it's a film that's been taped together, right?
Yeah.
So it's really easy to get a gem and then destroy like something that you've been working on, you know, for a long time. And for us, it was like Kim was working like at this restaurant, the Metropolitan, which was at Charles and Young. And I was, like I said, at the AGO, and we'd get some money, and it was like, you'd buy one cassette, you know, and it's like, you'd go out and you'd make, that's your movie, you know, it's going to be this long, right? And so, like, the idea of submitting it to the censor board, and it could destroy something that, like, you know, it's like a one-time thing, it was, like, really irritating. And I think that's also why we lost interest in the funnel because there was so much focus on manipulating and controlling them. That's why we moved to the Cabana Lounge, like at the Spadina. That's right, the Cabana Lounge at the Spadina Hotel. And we also, like, because I'd moved into the Cameron, I redid. They used to have a lounge that's run, now it's Video Cab that's in that lounge on the second floor at the Cameron. And I built the Alien Lounge. And so we'd have screenings at the Alien Lounge because we figured, you know, nobody knows about this and we can kind of like still operate, you know, without, you know, the censor board coming in. And because we were real, anything with authority, it was just like, you know, we just find way to fight it or subvert it or, you know.
Right. Yeah, we were talking to a lot of people who suggested that the funnel got a lot of flack because they complied with all these things.
I think that's probably why a lot of people just kind of stepped away and they just moved on to other. Also, don't forget, like, slowly, like, YYZ kind of came out. Like, there was all these artist-run centers were kind of starting to emerge. A-Space had been around for a while, but it's uptown, right? It was up on the, near Charles on the back street from Yonge Street there. So, you know, it's like all these places, if there was government money coming in, then there was focus on it. And we were always kind of trying to move away from anything that was government controlled. I think we never even, like, got Ontario Arts Council grants, you know, we'd figure other ways to get the money so we could totally control what we were creating, you know, so you don't have to answer to anybody. I still do it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I got two grants from the Canada Council, and both times was I didn't even apply for them. They just came because, like, if you have a show at the AGO, like, I remember we had a show in 88 at the AGO, and it was August, and I thought, oh, I got to apply, September 15th, the deadline, and a curator came and goes, oh, you don't have to apply, your grant is already there, it's already in your account, it should be there by now. Yeah, it's like people don't realize that.